The American Way is a comic book series about an unusual form of American propaganda. It's set in 1961 during the Cold War, when American superheroes vanquish communist villains in an ongoing series of spectacular battles. But the heroes and villains are creations of the government, the American government, for reasons we'll explain in a minute. Now the series is collected in the form of a graphic novel. The American Way was written by my guest John Ridley. He also wrote the screenplays for the films Undercover Brother and Three Kings. He's an NPR commentator and is working with Spike Lee on a new movie. John Ridley, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe the superheroes in The American Way.
Coming into the comic book, the graphic novel, the superheroes are meant to be icons of America, and also shorthand for heroes that may be more familiar to some readers. So you have your Superman archetype, your Wonder Woman, your Captain Marvel. But in The American Way, these characters are meant to represent aspects of America. So they have names like Old Glory and Amber Waves, Muscle Shoals, Ole Miss, the Mighty Delta, Southern Cross, and my favorite name for any of these characters is the East Coast Intellectual.
Describe the East Coast Intellectual physically.
The East Coast Intellectual is basically, he's the smartest man in America. He's incredibly intelligent, but represents East Coast sort of professorial intelligentsia.
Now, these superheroes are all part of a group called the Civil Defense Corps, which is what?
The Civil Defense Corps is ostensibly much like the Justice League or the Avengers. It's this group of heroes who come together to save the day from either alien invasions on some occasions or to fight these personifications of evil in America or around the world at that era. It's enemies that are very specific to a time and place and represent real evils that are out there. What we find out in the story is that the Civil Defense Corps, even though most of these heroes have real superpowers, it's sort of a sham. They put on these fights as shows, like wrestling, not in an Orwellian fraud, but to really give hope to America that our society is not going to end tomorrow in atomic ash, that we are not going to fall prey to communism. It's the idea that it's a grand lie to make Americans feel good and to feel safe. And the question becomes in this story, is any lie a good lie? And can you perpetuate these lies over time? What happens when reality overtakes the fraud?
How did you come up with this idea of superheroes who were created by the government to vanquish phony villains just to make Americans feel good and feel secure?
Well, part of the idea, and a lot of the story, for me when I write, I sit around and I think all the time, and I get an idea over here that kind of works, an idea over here that would be interesting, and then I wait for that thing that helps it all coalesce. And for me, the thing that really helped bring the story together was the Jessica Lynch story at the beginning of the second Gulf War, the Iraq War. Here was this young girl. She was out on patrol. Her patrol was ambushed. You know, as the story went, most of her comrades were captured or killed. She fought to the last bullet. She was taken to a secret location, but American commandos found her and an amazing rescue saved her, brought her home. And it's a great story. And it's the story that the Pentagon and the government put out. It's the story that most of the media ran with. And little by little, we found out that that was not actually the story. The idea wasn't that this story was not put out there because the government was evil. It was not entirely made up, but we wanted to believe. At the beginning of the war, who doesn't want to believe a wonderful story about a young girl, an American hero, who is rescued and saved in a spectacular operation? There was nothing wrong, essentially, with that story, except that it wasn't the truth. But we ran with it, and we believed it, and we liked what we were hearing.
One of the superheroes dies because of a heart attack brought on by his smoking addiction. And then he has to be replaced. So the marketing guy comes up with this idea, like, let's find a black man to be the first black superhero. Why does he want to do that? Why does he want to recruit a black man?
Well, the character who is the entree into the story is a guy named Wes, and Wes is a marketing executive and ends up losing his job. And one of his friends from college is Bobby Kennedy, and the Kennedys have just been elected and just been put into office, And Wes gets a call from Bobby Kennedy, and he says to him, look, I've got a job in government that I really want you to help me with. And Wes, being unemployed and his wife is pregnant, says, you know, look, I'll think about it. He comes down to Washington, and Bobby lays all this on him, that these guys are, these guys being the Civil Defense Corps, are kind of fake. But it's the most important job that we have right now is to make Americans feel safe and strong and secure. And we want you to spearhead this for us and our new administration. Wes, being a good liberal guy and also being a guy who wants to feel good when he looks in the mirror and looks at his wife, thinks that the Civil Defense Corps can do more. More than just representing where America is, they can represent where America should go. And he has this idea, which is we need to integrate this formerly all-white supergroup. We need to bring, in the parlance of the times, a Negro hero to the fore. And they realize that they can't just give a black man superpowers and put him in this group. The idea is that they will hide this guy behind a mask, call him the New American, and after he's a hero for 2 or 3 years, after America completely loves him, they reveal the fact that he's a black man. By the way, this is part of this story is actually based on reality. Lyndon Johnson, when he was vice president after Kennedy had just been elected and initiates the space program, he thought that one of the original Mercury astronauts should be black. And he thought that that would go a long way to quelling race relations in America. And when I heard that, that's another aspect that really helped bring this entire story together.
My guest is John Ridley. We're talking about his comic book series, The American Way, which is now collected in a new graphic novel of the same name. It's set in 1961 during the Cold War, when American superheroes vanquish communist supervillains in an ongoing series of spectacular battles. But the heroes and villains are creations of the American government in a campaign run by marketing experts to make Americans feel good about the government's ability to protect them. After the campaign gets off the ground, the marketing experts decide to create a black superhero. I want you to read the section from The American Way in which the marketing guy from this superhero Civil Defense Corps tries to convince the young African-American man to become a member of the Civil Defense Corps, to become one of these superheroes. And just like set it up in any way that you need to get us on the page.
Well, as you mentioned, you have the marketing guy, Wes, who's been charged with finding, much as with the Mercury astronauts, the guy who's got the right stuff. A black man, or again, as a Negro, as they would say at the time, who's got the right personality, who's got the right aptitude, and who can handle having his body transformed into basically a superhuman. They find this individual, a guy named Jason Fisher, who at the time is like a lot of young black people. He's very much a hothead. He's very much got a lot of opinions, but up to this point hasn't really engaged himself in the civil rights process. So as we come into this scene, Jason has been sat down in a room in the government, and like a lot of black people are probably sat down in a room by the government or government officials, doesn't like what's going on, and Wes has to convince him that he's actually there for a higher purpose. So we come in, this first line is from an angry Jason. Hey, I know my rights. You better let me see a lawyer, you lousy. This is Wes. Right, yeah, I'm the blue-eyed devil, and you're the oppressed minority, always getting shafted by the man. We did that dialogue already. You care to move on? So you're Jason Fisher, you're a Howard grad paratrooper with the U.S. Army. 3 years ago, you were discharged for striking another soldier. Jason, he made the mistake of calling me a nigger to my face, and I didn't strike him, I ripped his ear off. Wes, he was junior grade, you could have had him court-martialed. Jason, I don't know what military you were in. I was in the one that cares more about race than rank. The brass wouldn't have done... Wes, in the years since, you haven't held a job to speak of, despite having a master's degree... Jason, nothing America fears more than an educated black man. Wes, maybe America's not the problem. Maybe you are. Jason, do you even own a television? You see how they treat us, overcrowd us in the ghetto, lynch us down south? Wes, and what have you ever done about it except talk loud and act angry? What have you ever done for your people? Jason, what are you offering? Wes, just the chance to heal the country, be an icon to America, white and colored alike. But that's about it. Jason, the word is Negro, and that sounds like some blue-eyed crap to me. Wes, then accept my offer. Prove me a liar. Otherwise, You're just another Negro who wants to change things but won't do anything to get there. Do you have what it takes to be a hero?
What's going on in that scene? And who's playing who?
In terms of who's trying to get one over on the other individual?
Mm-hmm.
I think that both individuals honestly are coming into this trying to believe that they're doing what's right. I think for me, relating this to 2007, there are a lot of black people out there who are angry, and in some cases very rightfully so, but we have to ask ourselves, particularly with what's going on in America, where are we focusing our anger? Are we focusing at the system, or are we looking at ourselves as saying, look, we are part of the system, particularly now in writing this? I do want to speak to a modern audience, not necessarily write a love letter to 1961. Look, we're at a place where potentially a black man in the near future could be president of the United States of America. If that happens, there are a lot of black people in America who are going to have to give up the line that says America is racist. Now, that's not to say that there aren't now and there won't always be racists in America. But if a black man is elected president, we can't say that America is racist. So we have to sort of change our dialogue in terms of how we address other people in this country and also how we look at where we as black people are moving in this country. Also with Wes, I think there's a level of an individual, and particularly talking about people who are white people who are very much in the liberal camp, who think that they can talk through issues and intellectualize issues and in so make those issues either go away or be able to address them or make them better. I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think that for black America, we understand the ills and the evils of the extreme far reactionary right. I mean, that's what we've been up against since we got dropped off on a boat and got our teeth checked and were sold into slavery. On the other end, I think that there is extreme liberalism, and I think that there is danger in extreme liberalism. And I think that that's what we have to look at in terms of where we are now and where we are on a liberal plantation. And I do believe that there's a soft bigotry out there. And I do believe for us as black Americans, having succeeded when we faced all the dire consequences that were put against us, slavery and the failed Reconstruction and Jim Crow and the Civil Rights era, and we've succeeded against all those things. Why is it in some areas of black America we are still failing? I think we can't look towards the extreme right in those circumstances. I think sometimes we have to look towards the extreme left and how it treats us and what we need to do to move to the next level.
When you said that there are dangers of extreme liberalism, what were you referring to?
I think that there is an idea in some areas of the black community of eternal victimization, that it's always the white guy who's causing problems, that it's the government that's against us, it's racism that's against us, that we need affirmative action in all instances, that we need handouts, we need the largesse of white people to get ahead. I think that those ideas of black people, blacks who preach to black people that we are always victims, just reinforces in our head that we are victims. But you look at black America and you look at the successes, I don't think those two concepts, they actually equate with one another. How can we always be victims and yet succeed both in personal life, in public life, and in social life? Actually, both. Those are three things. I don't think that the idea that we are victims, yet we can succeed, they don't really jive with one another.
You work in movies, television, books, comic books. Are you satisfied with the diversity of ways in which African Americans are depicted in American entertainment now?
No, absolutely not. I think it's getting better, but you look at the success of The Cosby Show in the 80s, and you wonder why there aren't more images of middle-class blacks in television and movies and things like that. You certainly see more black people that are out there. I mean, you've got, Forrest Whitaker, winning an Oscar, and Jennifer Hudson winning an Oscar. It's taken for granted that there will be strong performances and good roles for people of color that are out there. And that's absolutely terrific. But in your day-to-day broadcasting, you just don't see a lot of positive images. And there's nothing wrong inherently with the hip-hop image. There's nothing wrong inherently with the images that are perpetuated in, say, like the NBA of black males. But, you know, with women in these hip-hop videos, I mean, they're always video hoes, almost always. I don't think that's particularly positive. The idea of black people being just about entertaining in sports and putting the ball in the hoop or running the ball down the field. Some of these individuals are wonderful individuals. They're involved in their communities. They're good people. I don't want to say that if you're involved in the NBA or you're an athlete, there's something inherently wrong with that. But is that the predominant image that we want to see out there as black Americans? And also in terms of real media, you can go through watching the news, you know, from morning to night and see so few black people delivering the news, adding commentary, putting voice out there. And generally when they are out there, they tend to be your Al Sharpton types who express a single point of view. And that then is considered to be the majority black point of view. And the reality is that Al Sharpton is in by no means does he express the majority of view of black people.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. I truly appreciate it.
John Ridley wrote the graphic novel The American Way. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.